in the limelight. According to a report, the Israeli regime used weapons made and funded by the United States to destroy projects and businesses in the Gaza Strip during its devastating 11-day war on the besieged enclave last year. We present you an article written by Daniel Bogoslov. The piece is titled, Israel Used U.S. Weapons to Destroy Assets and Aid Projects in Gaza. The article has appeared on the front page of the Intercept website. Last May, in an assault on the occupied Gaza Strip, the Israeli regime deployed hundreds of bombs, missiles and shells, murdering over 240 Palestinians and wounding more than 1,900 others. Despite Zionist regime's claims that it only targets combatants from Hamas and other Palestinian resistance groups, more than half of the martyred were civilians. At the end of the 11-day assault, tens of thousands of Gazans were displaced from damaged homes, already struggling in a region with a 50% unemployment rate, toxic water, and crumbling infrastructure. Thousands of housing units, hundreds of schools, and 19 healthcare facilities were damaged. Documents and reporting reviewed by The Intercept show compounding the devastating toll on Palestinian civilians. Weapons made and funded by the United States were used to destroy humanitarian projects and businesses in Gaza. The destruction reached multiple hospitals, water treatment facilities, and dozens of schools operated by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East, or UNRWA. Raad Jarar, Advocacy Director at Democracy for the Arab World Now, told The Intercept, "The vast majority of ammunition used by Israel is manufactured or subsidized by the United States." Raad Jarar added, "It's fair to say that every Israeli munition is subsidized by the United States one way or another by U.S. tax dollars. Impoverished in no small part thanks to a decade and a half long Israeli blockade, the Gaza Strip relies heavily on foreign aid to avert the worst humanitarian outcomes." According to documents compiled from the United Nations, the Palestinian Authority and human rights groups, more than 100 UNRWA facilities in Gaza were damaged in the 11-day bombing campaign in May of 2021, requiring over $1 million in repairs. Dozens more schools administered by the Palestinian Authority suffered similar damage. In 2014, during an earlier Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip, a Hellfire missile manufactured and paid for by the United States targeted an UNRWA school, murdering 10 civilians. The massacre drew widespread condemnation, even eliciting a rare rebuke from the Obama administration, whose press secretary decried it as totally indefensible. Michael Link, the recently departed United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of humanitarian rights in the Palestinian territories, said, "A major reason for the perpetuation of Israeli occupation and the deaths and suffering which accompany it is the extraordinary military, diplomatic and political support given to it, largely without conditions, by the United States." Michael Link added, "This American military assistance is provided, notwithstanding the fact that congressional laws governing U.S. weapons exports claim that recipient countries cannot be engaged in consistent patterns of gross human rights violations. While Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. military aid, it is subject to virtually no checks in operation, ensuring that U.S. weapons are not used to commit war crimes, destroy United Nations-funded projects, or damage the property of civilians in the Gaza Strip," Since 1948, the United States has provided the Israeli regime with over $150 billion worth in assistance, receiving in exchange a foothold in a region of massive strategic importance. The current model exists under a Memorandum of Understanding that President Barack Obama signed in 2016, committing to $38 billion in aid between 2019 and 2028, with an open-door policy for additional aid, like the $1 billion Congress gave the Zionist regime in March for its Iron Dome missile defense system. The aid system also provides cash flow financing, a system resembling layaway that allows Israel to purchase weapons in the present using money from the future. And it contains an offshore procurement exemption offered to no other country that allows the Israeli regime to spend U.S. tax dollars on its own weapons industry without disclosing how it spent the money to Congress or the American public. And of course, the United States maintains its own stockpiled weapons in the occupied Palestinian territories, available for use by the Israeli forces, despite Israel's status as one of the largest arms exporters in the world. In two instances, Israel tapped into the U.S. stockpile to wage campaigns against the Palestinian resistance group Hamas and the Lebanese Islamic Resistance Movement Hezbollah. The end result is an Israeli arsenal almost entirely composed of weapons made or subsidized by the United States. As bombs fell on the Gaza Strip last May, the smell of roasting nuts and sizzling potatoes was replaced with the overwhelming stench of burnt plastic. A potato chip factory and a Matouk ice cream factory, which once produced snacks in the hope of instilling a glimmer of joy in the blockaded strip, were completely destroyed in the bombing. Many of the companies established in Gaza's industrial zone did so under the pretext that the Israeli military would not bomb the commercial site. Financed by U.S. aid and fired on by U.S.-funded weapons, the area was thought to be protected under the auspices of the Oslo Accords, which created a special economic zone intended to supplant conflict with mutually beneficial free trade. Also impacted were the Foamco mattress factory, the main producer of mattresses for Gaza, the Abu Iskandar plastic factory, the Clever detergent factory, the Siksik plastic pipes factory, and the Al-Wadi food plant, resulting in tens of millions of dollars worth of damage. The factories employed 1,500 Palestinians and were severely impacted by the shelling in the early morning hours on 17th and 18th of May 2021. The Al-Ahli Arab Hospital, which received a $900,000 grant from UNAID to build a surgery center, was also damaged in the Israeli bombing campaign, as was Beit Hanun Hospital, another recipient of UNAID funding. While mechanisms for punishing war crimes perpetrated with U.S. support are selectively enforced against many other countries, the lack of scrutiny over the Israeli regime's forces' use of American weaponry is glaring. Amid last May's onslaught, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace detailed a number of U.S. laws violated by Israel's attacks on Gaza. These included the Foreign Assistance Act, which stipulates that aid cannot be provided to a country which engages in a consistent pattern of gross violations of internationally recognized human rights. Also, the Arms Export Control Act, which bans U.S. military assistance to countries using weapons for reasons other than legitimate self-defense. And the Leahy Laws, named after outgoing U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, which ban weapon sales to military units that have committed a gross violation of human rights. In May of 2021, as last year's bombing campaign drew to a close, Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, and several progressive members of the House of Representatives introduced resolutions to block a $735 million weapons package that included the same type of precision-guided bombs that the Israeli regime was already using to shell Gaza. Senator Bernie Sanders said at the time, "I believe that the United States must help lead the way to a peaceful and prosperous future for both Israelis and Palestinians. We need to take a hard look at whether the sale of these weapons is actually helping do that or whether it is simply fueling conflict." But the White House demurred. Then White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki claimed, "We have seen reports of a move towards a potential ceasefire. That is clearly encouraging." The Biden administration approved the sale. This May, Israel launched another bombing campaign on the Gaza Strip.
Ocean of Dua. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وكن اللهم بعزتك لي في كل الأحوال رؤوفا وعلي في جميع الأمور عطوفا إلهي وربي من لي غيرك أسأله كشف ضري والنظر في أمري
Dear listeners, as you have been previously with us, we were talking about the part in which Imam Ali alayhi salam in the Kumail supplication states, إلهي وربي من لي غيرك أسأله كشف ضري والنظر في أمري. My Allah and my Lord, have I any but you from whom to ask the remedy of my afflictions والنظر في أمري and regard for my affairs. About this part, we said, that the true nature and essence of supplication is turning to the Almighty Allah and no one else, is to cut our relationship ties with everyone and paying attention only to the Almighty Allah. When we are hopeful of Almighty Allah's mercy on us, this means we know that Almighty Allah has sufficient knowledge about us and we know that His creatures cannot do anything to solve our problems. That is why we have been ordered to turn to Him only and no one else. Let us have a look at some of the instances and the stories of the mercy of the Almighty Allah and the state of inqita' that that Imam Ali alayhi salam is mentioning in this part. It means cutting your relationship ties with anyone other than the Almighty Allah.
Therefore, my Lord, I ask you by your greatness not to let my sins and my misdeeds veil my supplications from you, and not to disgrace me by exposing those of which you have knowledge, nor to hasten my retribution for those vices and misdeeds committed by me in secret, which were due to evil-mindedness, ignorance, excessive lustfulness, and my negligence. O Allah, I beg you by your greatness to be compassionate to me in all circumstances, and be gracious to me in all affairs. My God, my nourisher, have I anyone except you from whom I can seek the removal of my afflictions and understanding of my problem?
Thank you, Allah,
God, let me hear,
feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God speaks with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
An ascetic scholar narrates that once a mother expelled his disobedient, disorderly son from home and told him to get out. Then she said, "You are not my child anymore." This son went out, played with the other children till the sunset, when all of them returned to their homes. When he saw himself alone without a friend, he returned home too and saw the door closed. So he put his head on the door, he cried, he called his mother to open the door for him. But the mother refused to do so. Meanwhile, a pious scholar who was passing by showed pity for the son, knocked at the door, asked the mother to allow this son to come home again. The mother said, "I accept your mediation, provided that you write something so that whenever my son disobeys again, he should get out of my home and he should not call me his mother anymore." The scholar wrote the same thing. He gave it to the young boy's mother, and they somehow reconciled again. A while later, that scholar passed the same house and saw the young boy weeping again and telling his mother, "Do whatever you want, but don't leave me alone." But the mother did not accept. The pious man waited to see what happens next. He saw the boy weeping continuously till he fainted from sorrow. The mother was looking at her child, got upset, opened the door and embraced him, saying, "Oh, the fruit of my eyes, come to home with me. And if I refused to let you in, I was not serious, but I wanted to prevent you from disobedience and wrongdoing." This story, dear listeners, is telling us that likewise, if a sinner feels his repentance and weeping is not accepted, he should not get hopeless. We have been ordered by the Almighty Allah to stay hopeful in all our affairs, in all our situations and states, even in the middle of committing the sins. We should be hopeless of the others except the Almighty Allah. But the true supplicant should ask Allah repeatedly, like that young boy who was at the door. The true supplicant should call out his Lord a lot, so he would get subjected to Allah's mercy and forgiveness. If Allah has regard for human affairs, his affairs would become organized. His problems would be solved ultimately, and his poorness elevated, because Allah's regard, mercy and blessing are infinite. But of course, it doesn't necessarily mean that if your problem is not solved, apparently the Almighty Allah has rejected you. No. Because as we said earlier, the reality of supplication is getting closer to the Almighty Allah. And by supplication, by talking to your Lord, you are getting yourself closer to Him, even if your request, even if your petition is not granted. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode of the program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you throughout my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Thank you.
On Thursday, leaders of Sweden and Finland, two European nations that opted for neutrality for years, flanked U.S. President Joe Biden while he threw his support behind their bid to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, at the White House.
And today I'm proud to assure them that they have the full, total, complete backing of the United States of America. Today, my administration is submitting to the United States Congress reports on NATO accession for both countries so the Senate can efficiently and quickly move on advising and consenting to the treaty.
I don't think those nations really ought to be scared of Russia. That would be really stupid if they were. Maybe they are that foolish and believe the narrative going on. I think it's more there's a power play. I mean, you look at the sanctions, that's where you really see the intent. And President Biden said this in Poland. He said, we intend that Russia's economy will be half of what it was over years. So that reveals he's planning to continue this for years. Zelensky, even if he were inclined to negotiate, will not be allowed to do it. And I think there's an intent to force governments to pick sides.
The move comes amid objections by Turkey, a NATO ally, and warnings by Russia. Ankara opposes Finland's and Sweden's accession to the military alliance, citing their longtime support for groups Turkey deems terrorists. Moscow, however, has warned of retaliation if Finland, a country that shares a 1,340-kilometer-long border with Russia, joins NATO. Russia's deputy UN representative, Dmitry Polyansky, went so far as to say that the two nations could turn into potential targets for Russia if they become NATO members. Finland and Sweden say they decided to join the NATO and reverse decades of military non-alignment after Russia attacked Ukraine. But Russia considers NATO's eastward expansion a threat to its national security. The issue was a critical reason Russian officials say pushed Moscow to launch its military operation in Ukraine in February. As the war between Ukraine and Russia entered its fourth month, the U.S. Senate passed a $40 billion bill to provide assistance to Ukraine. 86 senators voted for the bill, while 11 others, all Republicans, voted against it, citing its high price tag and the fact that it might not be offset. The bill earmarks $6 billion for arms to be purchased from contractors and sent to Ukraine. It also increases the presidential drawdown capacity from the $5 billion the Biden administration had originally requested to $11 billion. The drawdown capacity allows the president to send away arms and military equipment directly from U.S. stocks at times of emergency.
It used to be the case when you had votes for sanctions against Russia, it would only be two senators voting against. So I think the revolt against this policy is growing. And I can tell you from the campaigning I've been doing and speaking with hundreds of American voters, Americans do not want this war. They don't support spending all this money on weapons. They may not have a completely elevated view of it, but their inclination is to say, we are suffering here. We're paying $1 million a gallon for gasoline. We're running out of baby formula. Why are we doing this? And I want that to be known around the world that the American people are not represented by the policies of this administration.
The war and the subsequent sanctions on Russia have sent shockwaves across the globe, threatening the most vulnerable economies in the world that have yet to recover from the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's also creating a new global crisis, food shortages.
This is not just about Ukraine. This is about the poorest of the poor around the world who are on the brink of starvation as we speak.
The whole world, including the U.S. and its allies, is paying the price for the war and its ensuing events. The situation would only get worse if the conflict continues indefinitely. The economic, political, and military pressures against Moscow don't seem to contribute to any compromise from the Russian side. The U.S. has expressed its opposition to a prolonged war, but actions speak louder than words.
Tensions between Russia and Israel appear to be on the rise. Israeli media reports say Russian forces have opened fire on Israeli jets with advanced S-300 anti-aircraft missiles. The missiles were fired at Israeli warplanes after they attacked targets in northwestern Syria. The move is seen as a sign of significant shift in Moscow's attitude toward Israel. The unprecedented incident is said to have occurred on Friday night when Israeli jets targeted an area near the city of Masyaf, which killed several people. Israel's airstrikes on targets in Syria are countered by the country's anti-aircraft missile batteries. But this time, however, the S-300 batteries also opened fire as the jets were departing the area.
It is the case that these missiles, the S-300 battery, is operated by Russian military personnel, and that they would not have fired without permission from senior commanders. Okay, this is a break in the normal procedure.
Syria's S-300 batteries are operated by Russian military and cannot be fired without their approval. Israeli media reports claim the S-300 radar did not manage to lock onto the Israeli jets and thus did not present a serious threat to the fighter jets. But this would mark the first use of the S-300s against the Israeli warplanes over Syria. It's not clear whether the S-300 missile fire was a one-time event or if it was a Russian signal to Israel that it was changing its policy.
So this was the first use of it, and it was known to be done by Russian military personnel at Russian military command. But it also, they did not lock the radar on the planes. So the planes were never in danger. It's unclear from the reports whether they couldn't lock the radar on the planes or whether they just didn't lock them and just wanted to throw these missiles up there as a kind of signal and a warning to Israel that, you know, we may change our policy and we may take down some planes.
The development comes amid deteriorating relations between Tel Aviv and Moscow over Ukraine. Israel has backed Ukraine after the war began. Tel Aviv's stance has angered Russia. Russia's latest move against Israel would be a worrying development for Israel.
And that has to do, of course, with the whole reverberations of what's going on with Ukraine. And, you know, the Russians are realizing that and starting to act much more militantly, in the sense that they understand this is now a war for the future of a lot of things.
The Tel Aviv regime has repeatedly targeted the positions of the Syrian army and its allies, but has rarely acknowledged or discussed such operations. The aerial bombardment intensified in scale and frequency after 2011, when the Arab country found itself in the grip of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism.
Oh, it will continue. No question about it. Look, it's not going to even think about stopping until a plane goes down. If S-300s or some other effective anti-aircraft defense takes down Israeli planes, then there'll be a problem. So the Russians have signaled something here, and they didn't take down a plane. And until and unless they do, Israel's not going to change its policy on that at all. And even if they do, that would cause a problem for Israel, and they would have to think twice about it.
Damascus says Tel Aviv carries out attacks on the Arab country to aid terrorist groups against the Syrian army. It has repeatedly complained to the United Nations, calling the aggression a blatant violation of the country's sovereignty and international law. The development comes after warmongering rhetoric of Israeli officials against Iran and its allies. Just recently, Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said Tel Aviv would prevent Iran from transferring advanced capabilities to its allies in the region. But Iran has dismissed the threat, saying it's determined to help the resistance axis stand up against Israel's aggressive moves in the region.
Former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has visited Albania. Officially, the trip was meant to celebrate the centenary of U.S.-Albania diplomatic relations. But Pompeo's stance against Iran manifested itself after he went to the camp of a notorious terrorist cult there. Pompeo held a meeting with the leaders of the Mujahideen-e Khalq, or MKO, terrorist cult. Encouraged by the presence of terrorists there, Pompeo repeated his anti-Iran rant, expressing his long unfulfilled wish to see the Islamic Republic overthrown. The former CIA chief said that under the leadership of infamous Maryam Rajavi, the MKO has been laying the groundwork for what he called a, quote, free, sovereign, democratic republic of Iran.
The recent visit of Mike Pompeo to Albania is in a way a revitalization of the old connections that Mike Pompeo has with Israeli Mossad and the Iranian Mujahideens, who are terrorists.
Pompeo is not part of the current U.S. administration, but his rhetoric and deeds indeed reflect the deep-seated animosity of the U.S. establishment towards Iran and its government. During his tenure as the U.S. Secretary of State between 2018 and 2021 in the Trump administration, Pompeo and other belligerent politicians around him, most notably former National Security Advisor John Bolton, expressed an open secret regarding Washington's stance towards MKO terrorist cults. Pompeo and his team became the MKO sponsors in his delusional attempt to overthrow the Islamic Republic. Back then, the regime in Washington left no stone unturned to topple Iran, but failed miserably in the hysteric anti-Iran drive.
Pompeo was paid probably more than $150,000 for his visit to the Mujahideen camp.
Mujahideen e Khalq is a terrorist cult which is now based at a camp in Albania. The MKO regularly hosts big events in which top American and European officials make speeches in support of the group.
They run a paramilitary camp in the town of Manza in the region of Durrës in Albania. From Manza, the Mujahideens, they carry hostile and terrorist activities against Iran, but even against political Islam in general.
Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, former U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman, and former Director of Saudi Arabia's intelligence agency, Turki bin Faisal Al Saud, are amongst the top officials that have attended the group's events. The terrorist cult has been accused of being involved in various criminal activities in Europe, including human trafficking, with possible links to the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group. The MKO was formally designated as a terrorist group around the world, but the United States and the Europeans delisted it in recent years amid growing strains in ties with Tehran. The terrorist group also fought alongside Iraqi forces in the former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's war on Iran in the 1980s. Prior to that, it killed thousands of ordinary Iranians and officials, the number said to be in the tens of thousands. Support for anti-Iran terrorist groups in the US and Europe has remarkably grown in the Western countries, with many Western spy agencies actively involved in aiding and arming them.
Well, the US government has a long history of cooperating with terrorist organizations. Nowadays, we have many countries in the Middle East who complain from the U.S. support for different terrorist groups.
The Islamic Republic has already warned Europeans that their support for the MKO will be costly for them. Tehran has condemned the hosting of the group by Albania and is delisting by the U.S. and Europe.
On Saturday, a gunman attacked a supermarket in Buffalo, New York, killing 10 people and injuring 3 others. Most of the victims were African American, making the attack one of the deadliest racially charged mass shootings in the United States' recent history. According to the police, the detained suspect, identified as 18-year-old Peyton Gendron, drove over 200 miles to carry out the attack. The law enforcement also said they were reviewing a 180-page document published online detailing the gunman's motivations. In the so-called manifesto, the author describes themselves as a white supremacist concerned about, quote, the dwindling white population. The document also says that he chose the area for the attack as its zip code has a large black population, which was within the driving distance of where he lived.
the inability of the unsustainability of neoliberal capitalism. So there's less resources, there's scarcity, there's a job market is being affected. Everyone is affected by that, but their interpretation of what the problem is different. And for white extremists, white supremacist extremists, they blame immigrants, they blame black people, they blame. And so you're seeing these ideologies that are emerging, or mentalities, or not emerging. They've always existed, but they're responding to the intensification of the logical conclusions of neoliberalism and neoliberal capitalism, austerity, joblessness, you know, privatization, all of that.
The police are investigating the attack as a hate crime, as an act of racially motivated violent extremism. The teenager faces first-degree murder, a charge he has pleaded not guilty to. Among the victims were a father who was buying a birthday cake for his 3-year-old son, and Catherine Massey, a 72-year-old woman who was known for her civil rights advocacy. The tragic irony is that almost a year ago, she had written a letter to a local newspaper calling for stricter gun control measures. The Buffalo mass shooter managed to live stream his attack on a popular streaming service using camera gear mounted on his military helmet. Although the feed was taken down soon after it began, the issue reignited criticisms about the moderation of social media platforms. It bore striking similarities with the 2019 terrorist attack on two mosques in the city of Christchurch in New Zealand that killed 51 people. That attack was also streamed live on social media. The incident in Buffalo is considered the deadliest mass shooting in the U.S. so far this year. But some 200 other mass shootings were carried out since the beginning of January. Unofficial data suggests that over 320 people are shot in the U.S. every day. A recent report by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention showed that gun violence in the country rose dramatically in 2020, with homicides involving firearms surging by 35%, the highest level in 25 years. The report points to disparities in the rates of homicide based on race, ethnicity, and poverty. This study fails to single out the specific reason for such inequality, but cites the COVID-19 pandemic as a possible socioeconomic driving factor.
People having to seek their own interpretations of what's happening. We're seeing it like things like this shooting, and this is not the only shooting. There's other things that are happening where people are acting out, trying to figure out, you know, just acting out, reactionary, most extreme reactionary responses to what's happening. And it can only get worse. As long as capitalism and white supremacy and patriarchy are the rule of the day in the United States, they can't address the fundamental human needs of people, then things like this will get worse. And then as the media glosses over it and doesn't want to tell people the truth, they can only get worse.
Tragic incidents like these are a grim reminder of the need for tighter gun control laws that would prevent easy access to firearms and reforms that would rid the U.S. society of racial and ethnic biases.
Cultural news. Social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
A print art exhibition chronicling nearly a century's worth of artistic achievements by a Chinese woodcarver has been unveiled in the city of Suzhou near Shanghai. The carved into wood exhibit features nearly 80 of Huang Yongyu's woodblocks and prints. Woodblock printing is a form of Chinese art dating back hundreds of years. In this form, patterns are carved out of thick sheets of wood to create a type of multi-layered surface. The ink is applied in various stages to print the image and its colors. The humble 98-year-old artist said during his years of practicing art, he learned that sincerity mattered more than technique. The exhibition was launched in collaboration between Suzhou Museum and the Beijing Fine Art Academy. Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge is a 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, five deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past six decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtinaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Youssef Jalali from Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
The lush green oasis near Sudan's capital, Khartoum, has turned into a haven for dozens of exotic bears from all over the world. The sanctuary shelters over 100 bears of 13 different species. Here, visitors can feed lovebirds, parakeets, rosella bears, and many more. The owner of the sanctuary says he trained the bears over the years to make them human-friendly. Akram Yahia says he has a passion for bears and enjoys it when people come around to see the sanctuary. The sanctuary, which is part of the Marshall Nature Reserve, is a welcome break for the people from their hectic life in Khartoum and nearby cities.
He tried to create an environment that doesn't exist in Khartoum. These environments exist in other parts of Sudan, such as in the west of Sudan, in the east of Sudan, in rainy areas. These areas have environments such as this one, and perhaps even more beautiful. He created this environment in Khartoum, where there is not nature at all.
Domestic and foreign tourists are allowed there only 2 to 3 hours a day. The limited hours are so that the bear's living environment is not disturbed. The owner built the 400-square-meter sanctuary 4 years ago. Over the years, he has added trees, garden, pond, and mist nozzles for cooling off against Sudan's scorching heat. Yahia says he wants to expand the reserve in the future. Indonesians have held a dazzling event to celebrate Vesak, a day traditionally observed by Buddhists in South Asia and Southeast Asia. People gathered at the sprawling Borobudur Temple in central Java and released lanterns into the sky. That's part of prayers marking the birth, enlightenment, and death of Buddha, a spiritual teacher who lived during the 6th century BC. The release of lanterns symbolizes letting go of negativity. The occasion lasts 3 days, which includes collecting holy water, sending off lanterns, and meditation. This year, the event was limited to some 1,200 people because of the coronavirus risk. Because of the outbreak of the pandemic, the ceremonies typically receive 20,000 people at the massive temple complex.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A group of over a dozen penguins has been released back to the sea after being given a second chance to live.
The condition of these specimens, which fortunately could be reinserted, is very common to find. They are animals that appear stranded on the coast, found with malnutrition, dehydration, hypothermia, and a high degree of parasitism. Specialists call this condition the stranded penguin syndrome.
The penguins were rescued and taken to the Mundo Marino Foundation, where they were rehabilitated. They were kept warm and were fed liquids until they could eat fish again. Before their release, blood and other samples were taken, and a chip was implanted to track them. One of the penguins was a southern rockhopper, which is a species listed as endangered. Biologists at a rescue center say there are many reasons why penguins get stranded and malnourished. These include overfishing, global warming, and other environmental changes. Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, while winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinked through street buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacle and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You would have seen people around town at the moment, everybody's asking, what's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways, and that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up, and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point, and that's fun.
Daniel Bryan said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at a site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community. Chilean paleontologists unearthed a rare, fully intact fossil of what is known as a sea dragon discovered from a melting glacier deep in Patagonia.
It is the first complete and excavated ichthyosaur that has been found in Chile. It also corresponds to one of the most complete fossils ever found on the planet for the Cretaceous period. It is the only pregnant ichthyosaur that's been found on the planet from the era between 129 and 139 million years ago. So it's incredibly important.
The 4-meter-long fossil is nicknamed Fiona and swam the seas some 250 million years ago. Scientists say this specimen will help them understand this species and its embryonic development. The expedition lasted over a month because of the remote nature of the find in the Patagonian glaciers. Paleontologists had to make a 10-hour hike just to get to the site. They also had to camp in extreme weather conditions while maneuvering tricky, rocky surfaces. But collecting and transporting the fossil was a whole other story.
As we went down excavating, weakening the rock, we realized the skeleton was mostly complete, so much that the bones were pushed inwards and we had to make five blocks of approximately 200 kilos each to move it.
The blocks were then airlifted to the Rio Seco Natural History Museum in southern Chile to be prepared for exhibition. The fossil was first discovered by Ruth Pedro more than a decade ago, but because of the site's harsh terrain, its extraction was a complex challenge. Scientists also discovered over 20 other specimens of the same species during the expedition, bringing the total found in the glacier area to 100.
Stopping by and listening to street musicians usually changes our mood for the rest of the day. The experience would be different if one lies under the instrument while it is being played. And that's exactly what a pianist in America has done. Colin Huggins, a busker, wheels his grand piano more than a half a mile from a mini storage to New York's Washington Square Park. He lets people lie down under the instrument and feel the vibrations from the claviers in their bodies. Colin says he wants to help people recover emotionally from the intense disconnect they had faced during COVID lockdowns.
I've always wanted to accommodate feelings in the best way possible, and I want to do it with music, and this is the best way I figure out how to do it. Maybe someday I'll figure out a way to do it even better, and I won't need to push this piano here. But as of now, this is the best I've got.
New York was one of the hardest hit cities by COVID in the U.S. Like other places, the major city imposed lockdowns and tough curbs to contain the virus. Despite that, Colin continued playing on the streets, frequently to an audience of zero. He says he strongly believes that everything will be okay.
IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.